Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. We're only halfway through the year, but already 2020 will be remembered as one of the most significant years in American history. The COVID-19 pandemic that has killed more than 130,000 Americans, closed businesses and schools, and cost millions their jobs has had an impact on every American's life. Also, the protest and reckoning over racial injustice and inequality since the death of George Floyd while in police custody may be the catalyst for change in America. All levels of government are dealing with these issues this year, and of course, that includes the federal government. Our guest today is Pennsylvania's Democratic U.S. Senator Bob Casey. Senator Casey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Scott. Great to be with you. Thank you.
If you have a question or comment for Senator Casey, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Senator, there are many issues I'd like to discuss today, but I want to start with a question about your health. You reported in May that you had tested positive for COVID antibodies and that you had slight symptoms. I know you've donated plasma since, but just wanted to see how you feel and have you been tested since?
Well, Scott, thanks very much. I feel great. And one of the advantages of having so many antibodies is that I'm able to provide the plasma donation. So I've made 3 donations, plan to make more. But I'm feeling great. I was blessed that the impact of the limited impact that the virus had on me. I had fever symptoms and nothing more, nothing respiratory, which has to be a terribly frightening prospect for anyone. But I'm doing well. I've been very fortunate.
Now, you've experienced something that millions of Americans have gone through, but did it have an impact on how you look at the virus and the pandemic?
Well, yes, I guess in this sense. Number one is... It reminded me and should remind others about how easily you can contract the virus. And I was very careful. I was abiding by as much guidance as I could ascertain at that time, and was in Washington, but I was not going to meetings on a regular basis. A very limited contact with people at all. So it gives you an indication of how aggressive this virus is, and that's why when we get guidance from the CDC or the Dr. Fauci's of the world, plural, there are lots of experts out there, we've got to not just heed that guidance, but strictly adhere to it. That's why I'll continue to be an advocate for wearing masks and following all the guidance, because we should all assume, and I still am careful, even though they say if you have antibodies that you're okay, you can't spread it, I still wear a mask, and I still assume that I could be carrying the virus, and I could give it to someone. I think the way to operate is you should assume you have the virus, number one, and I know people don't want to hear this, but we have to say it, and number two, that the person next to you could get it from you. If that's your mindset, then you'll follow the guidance, and we'll all be a lot better off.
Yeah, that's why I asked you if you had been tested since, but we have a question from a listener. Tony says, we continue to hear that testing and contact tracing are the keys to getting the COVID-19 virus under control. And we also have heard that the U.S. is not and is not testing for the virus in high enough numbers. Why haven't we been testing more? What obstacles are in the way of testing at sufficient levels? What prevents the federal government from implementing a nationwide testing program?
Well, Scott, I think in one word, it's leadership. When the federal government had a sense of this virus way back in February, not March, February, the administration should have at that time committed itself, and the president should have committed himself to a national strategic effort on both testing and personal protective equipment. Neither has happened. And I know they will say, oh, well, we have X number of millions of tests. We are still not testing enough. All the experts tell us that. And we still don't have enough personal protective equipment for the next several months in every setting that would need it, especially in healthcare settings, whether it's nursing homes or hospitals. A lot of these the leaders of these institutions will tell us, yeah, we might be good for the next month or two, but there's example after example of where they're not prepared for the next several months. So it's a failure of leadership. And the idea that state governments have to come up with their own personal protective equipment and shop for it around the world is utter madness. We've never done this in war. If we're on a war footing, which we should be with the virus, we've never said states have to make their own war material when we're fighting World War One or World War Two. And there's no excuse for the failure of leadership. Congress has helped here, but Congress has to do a lot more. Congress should pass another bill. The United States Senate is being held up because we're working on nominations all the month of May, all the month of June. Now we're into July, and we go back in 2 weeks. We're probably going to be voting on nominations again. We've only had discussions about a next COVID bill, so we need a lot more work done on responding to the virus and responding to the jobs crisis, especially for a state like Pennsylvania, which has hundreds of thousands of people out of work from where we were in the month of March. And, Scott, just parenthetically on your last question, I had an antibody test, not a COVID-19 test, and there's no reason for me to have a COVID-19 test now that I know I have the antibodies.
Okay. All right. So you brought up that we should be looking at other bills. You're talking about another stimulus bill, correct?
No question that we need a bill that responds more thoroughly to both the virus and the terrible economic consequences that flowed from the virus. In other words, we need more help for Medicaid. States, here's the deal. This is as certain as night follows day. States will have to cut school district budgets, and they'll have to cut healthcare dollars because they have to balance their budgets starting this month. And if the federal government doesn't help states and local communities, like the House has proposed, $845 billion, something in that range, then states are going to have to cut, local governments are going to have to cut public safety. That's just a certainty. And for the United States Senate, the majority in the Senate, to just say, well, we'll get to these issues later, is just irresponsible. We have a jobs crisis and we have a public health crisis. We got to respond to both. I've got a Medicaid bill that I think makes a lot of sense increase the matching dollars for Medicaid.
Yeah, let's talk about that because, you know, this is something that the bill you're talking about, I don't know how you have you explain it, but it's tied to a state's unemployment rate. So explain how it works now. We're talking about the level of Medicaid dollars coming from the federal government to the states. How does it work now, and what would your bill do?
Yeah, it basically says that, look, you need Medicaid in the middle of an economic downturn. And we can't. We're seeing the what happens when the politics doesn't work for increasing the matching rate that the federal government pays for Medicaid, and states, governors of both parties, red states, blue states, everybody in between is saying we need Medicaid dollars now. The majority in the Senate says no, 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 over and over again. They are hostile to Medicaid. They want to cut it, not expand it. When you have an economic downturn, you need Medicaid to keep people alive, to keep them insured, and to help on the economic trauma that states are enduring right now. What my bill would do is to say that in any quarter, we'd look at a state's unemployment rate, and then we would compare that rate to a state-specified threshold, a threshold that this bill designs to mimic full employment. And in other words, it would be a trigger. It wouldn't depend upon whether Republicans or Democrats control the House and the Senate, Democrat, Republican, president. Doesn't matter. It'd be an automatic trigger that would help states across the board that have high unemployment rates and need more Medicaid matching dollars. And then when the economic crisis subsides, the trigger would be off, and you wouldn't have to provide as much federal matching rate for Medicaid. It makes a lot of sense. We this should have been done years ago, and we need it now because we're going to. My concern is that the jobs crisis will long outlast the virus.
What do you mean by that? Why? I mean, there are people starting to go back to work now. I mean, when we say, you know, one of the things that I think a lot of people we need to point out is that when we hear those jobs report that 2 million jobs or 2.3 million jobs were created last month, then no, they weren't created. For the most part, they were right. People going back to work. So what do you mean by that? Did you think that the jobs crisis is going to last longer than the COVID crisis?
Well, give you an example. The unemployment rate in our state never went above 10 in the Great Recession, right? We know that in the Great Depression of the 1930s, it went way above that. It was probably hovering around 20. Now the unemployment rate, as of April, hit a high of 15. I expected May, the state numbers are always a month at least behind. But May and June are going to be better than that, obviously, for Pennsylvania. That's great. But when the national rate goes from 14.7 down to what it was like 11, that should not be the time for high fives and cartwheels that everything's getting better. We're in an economic crisis, and it's going to remain that way not just for months. With Pennsylvania and this country will be in an economic and jobs crisis in for the rest of 20 and for a good part of 2021. I hope not 2022. And what do I mean by that? I don't mean that we're not going to see a plunging unemployment rate. That's great. But even if Pennsylvania went from 15 to 13 to 11 to 9, we're still going to be at almost record highs. And once you get to those numbers, you're dealing with the people whose jobs are hardest to replace, the people who are chronically unemployed. That's why I say the jobs crisis, in my judgment, is likely to outlast the virus, because even if you get a vaccine for the virus in late 20, which I think is unrealistic, but say early 21, the jobs crisis will still be with us.
Well, and all the things that you list, Senator Casey, have an impact. They're intertwined with one another. I mean, you talked earlier about schools. You talked about communities.
Yep.
Pennsylvania is going to have a $5 billion budget deficit by this time next year. If those jobs don't come back, that means those are taxes not being paid. I take a look at this and just think, this is overwhelming. This is something we've never had to, as a nation, deal with before. How are we going to deal with it now? It kind of feels like we're not being proactive, but we're just kind of reactive at this point.
Well, I do think, Scott, Congress had the right approach. Even the Republican Senate had the right approach in the month of March and at least the first half of April. We really haven't legislated since the middle of April. Think about it. I mean, we've had some changes made to the Paycheck Protection Program, but since mid-April, the United States Senate has pretty much been dormant on responding to the virus. And we've allowed these months to go by. The virus is still raging. The economic challenge is still there. And you would think in the Senate that we're some kind of nominations machine instead of a legislative body that's supposed to respond to the greatest public health and economic crisis we've had in decades. So what we should do in late July when we go back is pass a substantial COVID bill. The majority leader, I think right now, Leader McConnell, is very much thinking about a very limited bill. We don't need a limited bill. We need something that deals with funding Medicaid for the states, helping them get through their budget years, because states and city governments and county governments have to balance their budgets. That's why the federal government is kind of the funder of last resort. So we need help on Medicaid. We also need help just with broad-based state and local support. We need help for food assistance. We still have a food insecurity, a hunger crisis in a lot of communities. We haven't responded anywhere nearly appropriate to that. Our side has been trying to get increases to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP. We used to call it food stamps, trying to get help for that for a long time. So we need substantial help. We should not totally eliminate the unemployment support, because that's going to run out at the end of July. Now, some people think the $600 is too much, and it's incentivizing people to stay at home. Well, if that's the case for some folks, maybe you wind it down. But to completely end it, to have a cliff, so all the month of August, all the month of September, all of October, no help for unemployment insurance. That's the Republican position right now, and that is a recipe for more economic trauma in the lives of families.
Could you put a dollar figure on what you and Democrats are looking for? And are we talking about another stimulus? Is it actually a stimulus or an economic aid package?
Well, I think it has to be something that provides stimulus, but also responds directly to the ravages of the virus. For example, in addition to the Medicaid bill, I got a nursing home bill. It's the leading bill in the Senate to provide $20 billion more, which is not, when you think about the fact that we've lost 55,000 people in nursing homes, $20 billion investment in proven practices to get that death number down and get the case number down is a bargain when you think about it. So they're the kind of things we still have not responded appropriately or fully to the virus, and you have to deal with the, as you mentioned, the stimulative effect. But look, here, Scott, you know what the House did. The House, about 2 months ago now, passed the HEROES Act, which added up to about $3 trillion, which is about what we had spent up to that point in time, when you consider the CARES Act and the other several pieces of legislation. Should it be $3 trillion? Maybe not. But should it be very limited, a couple $100 billion? That's just not going to do it. When you add up the need for Medicaid and food assistance and state and local help and unemployment insurance, maybe more help for small businesses that is better targeted to truly small businesses and minority-owned businesses who got the short end of the stick in the small business program. So we still have a long, long way to go in terms of what the federal government should be doing instead of sitting on our hands in the Senate and voting on nominations. Look, with all due respect to federal judges and agency heads, they are not as important right now, for their nominations are not as important right now as the virus and jobs.
That almost sounds political. Is it to be done before the election in November? Is that the reason behind Senator McConnell's reasoning there?
Well, I don't get it, because let's forget the right thing to do for a moment, which is to respond to the jobs crisis and the virus, COVID-19, the disease. Let's just say all you're thinking about is crass political benefit to yourself. Mitch McConnell, Donald Trump. The best thing for them to do is to focus on jobs and the virus. But it also happens to align with what is best for the country. So it is not good for either political party, in a crassly political sense, to ignore the challenge of the virus or the jobs crisis. So it doesn't make any sense to me. And I think that's why you see Republican politicians in trouble politically, because people get it. They know that they know that enough hasn't been done. They know that their family's still hurting, and they expect Washington to act, because Washington has the resources to act that state and local governments don't have.
We're going to talk more with Senator Casey in just a moment about a few other issues. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest today is Pennsylvania Senior U.S. Senator Bob Casey. We're talking about the coronavirus. We're going to be talking about racial inequality and justice in just a few minutes, some of the issues that have come up recently over the past month or so. 1-800-729-7532 is the number to call. On Twitter, we are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Senator, you talked about the $3 trillion package earlier. We're throwing numbers around here, trillions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars. You know, we don't hear much about a budget deficit or the national debt any longer, but just a basic question, where is all this money going to come from?
Well, Scott, there's no question that when you're in a crisis and when you're you have an economy in the ditch driven by the adverse impact of this virus, you've got to spend to get out of the ditch. And there's no question that when we get beyond this, we're going to have to reassess where we are from a fiscal standpoint. But one area of great consensus, you know, the first several bills that were passed way back in March and into the middle of April, there was unanimity, meaning everyone said yes. We had votes in the United States Senate we've never had in our history or not in recent history, 96-0 was the vote on the CARES Act, for example. Four senators were in quarantine who couldn't vote. But unanimous vote prior to that in the so-called Families First Act. And virtual unanimity on adding dollars for the Paycheck Protection Program, which is now up to about $670 billion. So that kind of consensus recognized that you had to put the fiscal questions off until you get the car out of the ditch. Because, look, there's no other entity in our society, no private sector entity, no bank, no government entity at any level can deficit spend to jumpstart the economy. So once we get out of the ditch, obviously we're going to have conversations about where we are from a fiscal point of view. But there's going to be no fiscal conversation if you don't have a growing economy, and we just have to dig out of where we are.
When you say a fiscal conversation, I mean, what are the options, or has that even been thought about at this point? I mean, tax increases, cuts, what are we talking about?
No, there hasn't been a lot of discussion yet, but look, we had a tax bill that was voted on the United States Senate way back in December of 2017. It went through the Senate like grease lightning. It went through between Thanksgiving and Christmas. And it was an obscene giveaway. The whole bill, in my judgment, with rare exceptions of some provisions, was a giant obscenity, because it gave permanent relief to corporations, and workers got very little. The middle class got very limited relief. And if you were very rich, or if you owned a big multinational corporation, you had a bonanza the likes of which we've never seen. So that blew a hole in the federal budget to the tune of about $1.5 trillion to $2 trillion. And so that's one of the reasons we're going to be in the hole that we're likely to be in the next couple of years. So we have to reconsider, I think, some of those corporate giveaways, and we have to reconsider, frankly, what rich people got, not only in the 2017 bill, but what they got since the days of Ronald Reagan. The super rich have never had a better tax environment over the last 30 to 40 years, and it's about time they started helping the country, especially at a time of need.
Well, you know, that's in that argument, that debate does go all the way back to President Reagan, and we can talk about that some other time. I want to get on to something else. Then the nation hears a story like what came out of the Small Business Administration yesterday. As part of the $660 billion Small Business Relief Program, the PPP program, the SBA reported this yesterday, 90,000 companies in the program took the aid without promising on their applications that they would rehire workers or create jobs. That was the whole idea behind it, or at least that was one of what you had to do to get that money. How does that happen, Senator?
Well, there are two issues there, two problems. One is when you're designing a program like that in short order, and there's no guidebook, there's no book on the shelf that says here's how you deal with a pandemic, a novel coronavirus where you don't know much about it at the beginning or enough about it. So you're designing a program quickly to respond. I think it was the right thing to do to have the program. But then when you couple that with very limited oversight, and that's one of the things we're going to have to do, and we've tried to start it on our end, is to do oversight of the existing ongoing programs, not oversight on or have hearings on other issues. And the majority in the Senate's been resistant to aggressive oversight, calling in administration officials and cross-examining them on the implementation of the program. So that has to happen more than it is, and the fact that it hasn't happened is a problem. But look, you can only excuse the urgency of the moment when you're designing a new program so much. You have to do oversight, and you have to press the administration, as I have on nursing homes, for example. I've been highly critical, and I'm going to continue to be critical when it comes to their poor response to nursing homes, where it comes to 55,000 people dead in nursing homes when you add up the residents and the workers together. There's no excuse for those kinds of numbers. We got to get those numbers down. And so you need to have the kind of oversight which has not happened. But I don't think the problems with the Paycheck Protection Program should be the reason that you abandon it. But you have to insist that the companies do more to keep their workers on the job. Look, I had the same problem with this obscene tax bill in 2017 I talked about, because I introduced an amendment which Republicans in the Senate rejected, which said if you want a tax break, then every time you get help with a tax break, you've got to make sure that the workers benefit. And Republicans rejected that. So workers, once again, are left out of policy, and corporations get to walk away with more help.
Well, when you talk about nursing homes here in the state level, of course, there has been criticism as well with 70% of the deaths in Pennsylvania that have come from nursing homes. Again, it seems like one of those things, whether it's in Washington or Harrisburg, that we were slow to respond to where many of the deaths, most of the deaths, in fact, were occurring. Senator, I know we only have a few minutes left, and we're getting a lot of emails. We'll pass those along to you, to your office, I should say, and maybe get a response.
That's great. Thank
some
you.
Of those. Want to switch gears. In response to the death of George Floyd in police custody, you were one of many Democratic co-sponsors of the Justice in Policing Act. Now, this is comprehensive legislation, but what are the major goals of that bill?
Well, Scott, the one thing we have not had in our criminal justice system, and particularly in policing, for a long time, I think this is a decade-long failure, is accountability. And if you want to know the difference between the Republican bill that I voted against moving forward, because I'm not going to advance a bill that is very weak and does nothing about accountability. And accountability means that when a police officer engages in conduct that is unlawful, there has to be a consequence. You can't just say, oh, well, he or she leaves work for a period of time and then is reinstated when someone's constitutional rights are violated. So when it's more broadly the Democratic caucus in the Senate, along with the Congressional Black Caucus, did most of the work on the bill. But when I supported that bill, I was focused on that basic measure of accountability. And these aren't just, theoretical. We're talking about what happens when a law enforcement official violates the constitutional rights of an American citizen. And I believe that there has to be a consequence when there's criminal conduct, and that's what the first provision of the bill deals with that, or when there's a violation that where the victim of that violation wants to bring a so-called 1983 action to recover damages. Those two, the civil and criminal remedies here, are pretty weak under federal law right now. They are almost never successful in a civil context or in a criminal context. So we need to make sure that we can protect people's constitutional rights. We need to strengthen these pattern and practice investigations by the United States Department of Justice. DOJ should have subpoena power to get more information when they're investigating a police department or investigating a particular case. So there's a lot more we can do on accountability, and that's what the basic difference is right now. I'm hopeful, though, Scott, that because this conversation has started with urgency, the fact that there is any bill even considered in the Senate is significant. So we have to keep working and try to get a bipartisan bill.
Well, see, that's one of the things I wanted to ask about. I mean, at times it seems as though Republicans and Democrats are far apart. But you're right in that this is a time where there seems to be agreement, universal almost agreement, that something has to be done. Are you that far apart, between Republicans and Democrats, or will there be something that will come out of the Senate?
Well, we were far apart, but I think the fact that you have another opportunity, because Leader McConnell changed his vote from yes to the Republican bill to no, and that was just strictly procedural, so that we can reconsider the issue. So with that opportunity, and I think with some good dialogue since then, I think we can come together. Because, look, when people were protesting on the street, and proclaiming a different justice system, when they were marching and mobilizing, using their voice and casting their vote, they were demanding transformative change, not just limited change, not just nibbling around the edges, transformative systemic change to a system that is infused with racism. And many, many more Americans believe that now, that this is a system infused with racism, and you got to do something about that if you call yourself America. And I think people's views on these issues have changed, and that's compelling legislators in Washington to do a lot more. I've got to do more. I haven't done enough in this issue. And the good news for the country is I have a lot of company where people are starting to realize that they have to dedicate more of their time as legislators, more of their day, more of their month, more of their year to this issue.
Senator Casey, I want to thank you very much for being with us today. We're almost out of time. Thank you. There are a lot more issues that we could talk about, but I'm glad you took the time today to talk to us and talk to our audience. Thank you for being with us.
Scott, thank you very much.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Where you live may play a role in predicting future COVID-19 disease spread, not only because of how government agencies are responding to the crisis, but based on the likelihood people living there will follow the health guidelines that have been put in place mostly by the Centers for Disease Control. A recent Penn State College of Medicine study found that several U.S. cities may be at increased risk of surges because the residents seem unwilling to follow certain mitigation practices. We're just halfway through the year, but already there are a lot of cases that we've seen since the beginning of March, and we're wondering whether that has a lot to do with what that maybe that has been influenced by people not following those guidelines. Joining us today is Dr. Robert Lennon, an associate professor of family and community medicine at Penn State College of Medicine. Dr. Lennon, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, sir. Thank you for having us on.
Dr. Lauren Vanskoy is co-director of Qualitative Mixed Methods Core at the Penn State College of Medicine. Dr. Vanskoy, good to have you on the show today.
Thanks so much for having us.
If you have a question or a comment about the research, and by the way, you can take the survey on our website, WITF.org/smarttalk. But if you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@WITF.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So I'll direct this to both of you, but you can decide which one wants to answer. What were you trying to find out with this research?
Well, I'll take that one. What we were interested in finding out was, how likely is it that the recommendations the CDC makes will actually work? And the reason that's a difficult question to answer is not that the recommendations themselves are good or bad. It's that however good they are, if people don't follow them, it won't make that much of a difference. So very early on in pandemics, just like we are now, even 3 months into it, we're still early. We don't have a vaccine. We don't have a cure. What stops the spread is how well people follow these recommendations. So our goal was simple. Let's ask people, are they going to follow it?
And what did you find out?
We found out that there were significant regional differences. So this is information from a global survey. It's available worldwide. Currently, we have over 18,000 responses. We looked at preliminary data in 5,000 responses in the United States. We broke that down by zip code allocation so we could see regions where folks were. And there are places like Dallas, Texas, which reports 71% of its people will most certainly avoid touching their face. And then there are places like Atlanta, Georgia, where only 44% of people will avoid touching their face. If 44% of the people only are doing these, following these recommendations, the chances are it won't work very well.
You know, when I saw the results of the survey and I saw that 44%, I'm thinking to myself, you know, and I think we all have learned how often we touch our face, but who makes a conscious effort to say, I'm not going to touch my face? I just, that was one of the questions that kind of blew my mind. Like, who makes a conscious effort to say, you know what, I'm not going to follow CDC guidelines and not touch my face?
I think that people weren't so much making a conscious effort as they were recognizing that they're simply not capable of doing it. An interesting thing about the mask wearing is that if you wear a mask, it's harder to touch your face. You can still touch your eyes, but you can help prevent contagion by not touching your mouth through the mask. So I don't think it's in as much intentional violation or willful violation as it is an honest assessment of, am I really going to stop touching my face or not? Am I really going to wash my hands?
I guess, Dr. Leonard, one of the things I equated it to was mask wearing and how so many people out there, even today, are so adamant against wearing masks. And I say so many. I know that it's a small percentage compared to the percentage of people who do wear masks. But still, there are those who are militant against wearing masks. Any idea why that is?
Well, that's a great question. The study that we have, that we've analyzed in the preliminary data, this was all done before mask wearing really took effect. The data on mask wearing we're still analyzing. We do have some. A brief review of it, though, there's a couple camps of folks. There's a group of folks that doesn't wear masks because they don't think it will make a difference. They think that it is kind of a myth or some kind of political machination to make people do things. And that's, we know, data-driven, that's just not reality. The reality is that wearing masks does decrease the spread of the disease. There's another group, though, that doesn't think that they will be in a position where it makes a difference. So, for example, people go to the park, and they think, well, I'm going to the park, I won't be around anyone, so I don't really need to wear a mask. And what they don't realize is, even if there's not that many people there, they're walking from their car right next to other people. They're walking down the path right next to other people. So those people are, you know, kind of morally more innocent. They're not trying to hurt anybody, but not really recognizing why it's so important that they wear it.
Hmm. Dr. Vanskoy, there are several, and Dr. Lennon mentioned a couple of them, but what were the measures that the survey was looking for?
Yeah, we designed the survey to figure out not just sort of what percentage of people were following recommendations and what their beliefs were about the recommendations, but we are also using qualitative methodology by letting people free type in their feelings, their opinions, their perceptions, their worries. And so we've been getting what we call mixed methods data so that we can understand not just, you know, are people willing to follow yes or no, but why are they not willing or why are they willing? What are they worried about? And so this is data, the qualitative data is still being analyzed from the global survey, but from our study that we did in Pennsylvania, we found a lot of really interesting things about why people aren't following recommendations. And again, like Dr. Lennon said, this was before mask wearing was required or even recommended. But we are finding that people were really, the barriers were things, not, again, like we were talking about, it wasn't that people were purposefully touching their face or purposefully avoiding following recommendations, but they were acknowledging that it wasn't possible for them. So at the time of the survey, we were talking, it was in March, right, when social distancing was being implemented. And what folks were saying is, you know, I can't follow the recommendations because I have an elderly grandmother that I have to go and visit and care for, or I have a family of five and I have to go to the grocery store. And so people needed health care. They were worried about loneliness. So there were lots of sort of reasons why folks were not following recommendations. And then we were also really surprised. We kept the survey originally. We kept the survey apolitical sort of purposefully because we wanted it to be about health recommendations and health behaviors. But the qualitative data just exploded with political messages and distrust, concerns about mixed messaging and misinformation. And I think that the mask wearing has just sort of, you know, doing the 180 on the mask has really confused people. And we sort of saw it early on in the data where folks were saying, you know, I don't understand why we aren't being recommended to wear masks. I see everyone in China wearing a mask. And now, of course, the recommendation has changed and is even mandated in the state of Pennsylvania. Yeah. So our qualitative data is really getting us some of these deeper meaning behind our findings.
A couple of things there. When you said that you tried to keep it apolitical, good luck with that.
Yeah, well, it was
you know that. Yeah, and you found out. But I mean, it's a shame that you know, this has become so political in so many people's minds. But that qualitative data that you're talking about, that seems like it would be very, very valuable because you do get to hear what so many people are thinking about this. But just looking at it, I mean, you're talking about basics that you were asking people about. Don't touch your face, washing hands, mm-hmm. social distancing, staying home. As Dr. Lennon mentioned, really the only, the washing hands, social distancing, stay home, the U.S. total all over 90, well, no, social distancing was 86%, but 90% washing hands, 95% staying home. But don't touching your face, 59%. I guess it is good to hear that people are not doing that on purpose. You know, it's funny. I'm sitting here, and as I'm listening to you, I scratch my nose. So, you know, just, yeah, and I'm consciously not thinking about it, you know.
Right.
But so one of the reasons that you wanted to do this is to predict where there would be some surges. Have you found some correlation between your numbers that you found? And again, a lot of this is from April. Has there been a correlation between some of the lower numbers where people will adhere to these guidelines and an uptick in cases?
So anecdotally, we can say yes. Mathematical is a powerhouse analytic company. They're actually going to do the full formal analysis of this, and that hasn't been done yet. But just if you look at our data, you can see that the two big low spots for avoid touching your face, most certainly, Atlanta, Georgia, and the D.C. metro area. Look at the news. Where are the you know, what is Atlanta doing right now? They're shutting back down after having opened back up. And, you know, some of these communities, they're now talking about it prematurely. Is that formally studied yet? It is not. But just looking at it, we were like, yeah, I wouldn't, you know, 2 months ago when we put this together, my comment to the coworkers was, boy, I wouldn't want to go to Atlanta right now. And here we are 2 months later and we're seeing that they're shutting things down again.
Yeah, and I can just add to that that in Pennsylvania, when we did a survey in 6,000 patients in Pennsylvania or individuals living in Pennsylvania, we found pretty good intent to follow recommendations. You know, of course, there were some that you know felt distrustful of the recommendations, but we found pretty good. Intent to follow, and at least anecdotally from my perspective as a physician here at the Hershey Med Center, we're seeing a decrease in cases. So while, you know, it's certainly you can't put causation into what the public's doing and necessarily all of the numbers that we're seeing in the hospital or not seeing in the hospital, but it does seem to me that the area, it's not surprising to me having knowing our data and then also rounding in the hospital and seeing that our numbers here in our area are very well controlled, it's very reassuring to me.
You know, it's funny how we've funny, not ha-ha funny, but interesting how we notice that. It's become the new norm when someone isn't social distancing. We notice it. Someone's not wearing a mask. I mean, I've talked to so many people who have said, oh, I was in such and such a store, and there were three people in there without masks. Mm-hmm. That this has become the new normal. I don't know whether any of the qualitative information that you have shows that. Have you seen any kind of trends? I know this started in April, but have you seen any kind of trends with people changing their attitudes?
Yeah, so actually there's a couple ways to look at that. One is just in knowledge alone. When we were making the survey, this was just when everything was starting out, and a difficult thing we had with assessing knowledge is that things that nobody understood on Monday were so common by Thursday you couldn't use it as a question. So we're definitely seeing these changes over time. And one of the things that came out of qualitative data that was we thought was quite interesting is a number of people said, I'm not worried about myself or my family following these recommendations. I'm worried about my neighbors. There was definitely an other concept in the qualitative data saying, I am, you know, so-and-so is not doing this. These people are not doing this. And it's the problem with that is, one, it's good to have communities policing themselves, but the downside of it is you have this us-against-them mentality building where folks don't trust the people around them.
Yeah, that absolutely is all over the qualitative data is, you know, I'm doing it all right, but I see people out there that are not, and that's what worries me the most. There was a lot of talk about, you know, epidemiologic concerns and public health concerns, and of course that was all wrapped up in, you know, political distrust and anger at the federal response. Interestingly, in our Pennsylvania survey anyway, the federal response was, there was a lot of data, and this is a primarily Republican area, there was a lot of distrust and anger directed at the federal government, but there was fairly positive responses for our local government, our state officials, Dr. Levine, and their responses. And so that was another trend that we saw, is that the local people were turning to the local state-level authorities, but were very angry, upset, and distrusted of the federal responses.
Did you actually hear Dr. Levine and Governor Wolf mentioned by name?
Yeah, oh yeah, many times, many mm-hmm. times. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's part of our analysis, actually.
I guess this email from our listener, Karen, could be part of your qualitative responses. I'll give you another one here right on the air. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't address the exact questions that you ask, but it shows that there are concerns about specific things. She says, why aren't we getting more info and discussion about COVID-19 and shared air, especially indoors, and about how controlling aerosolized virus particles may be able to be addressed in our schools, offices, and public retail spaces? We can all wear masks, which protect others from us, but don't protect us as much, and stay 6 to 10 feet apart. But indoors, we're still sharing air. Is that something that anyone addresses in your report?
In the qualitative data that I looked at, which, again, I've only analyzed formally the state of Pennsylvania data, we asked actually a question of exactly that, like, what questions are remaining for you? What information have you not gotten that you would like to get? And folks were basically reporting that they had, at the time, you know, testing. We weren't talking about masks, and we weren't talking about reopening. And actually, at the time of our survey, we called it social isolation as opposed to social distancing, which is the term we use now. But the questions at that time, where everything was people were scattering to the wind and leaving work, the questions people had at that time were, you know, what about tests? Where can I get a test? Are they available? How should I get tested? When should I get tested? There were questions about viral behavior. How long are you deemed contagious? And how long do I need to stay home? So in our data at that time in late March, that was the issue. Then we developed a follow-up phone interview. So we completed 90 interviews. They haven't been analyzed yet, but 90 interviews of purposefully selected folks from our original survey to ask the qualitative questions about the issue of the day, which was now at that point reopening, and I guess it's still an issue of the day. And so we asked some questions about reopening and what their worries and fears were about reopening. And our next set of studies, we're going to be looking at issues related to the next phase, which is emerging, obviously, mask wearing, and are you going to be following or wearing masks, or why not? And then the next step from there will be vaccine. Once a vaccine is developed, will people get it? And so what we're learning in our qualitative data is that our data is telling us the next thing to ask, and we're seeing signals of it before it explodes in the news. It's just really fascinating to watch.
It really is. You know, I see that, and I'm sure you have more since then, but I was looking at your release, and you had over 5,000 responses from across the country. One of the big issues that many people have now, and I'm wondering if you are seeing this, but you just touched on it briefly, about students going back to school. Mm-hmm. There are so many people who are just wondering, I mean, educators included, how that is going to safely happen for staff, teachers, principals, students, not bringing it home. Is that something, is that one of the issues that, concerns that the people have?
Absolutely. And we had a number of responses, particularly out of State College, talking about that very concern, mm-hmm. Saying, hey, look, we're all pretty good now, but in about 4 months, right, we have, you know, how many, 60,000 students coming back from around the country. What are we going to do about this? The university has set up a number of things for that, and all the districts are doing things on that. But the reality is we're not really sure how it's going to work. And part of that is, as you look through age groups, especially when you get into the very younger ages, are kids, you know, 6 and 5 years old, are they going to wear a mask? Are they going to wash their hands? Are they going to social distance? You think about a playground with kids, are they not going to be wrestling around? The answer is realistically probably not. So we don't know what that's going to look like. It's definitely a concern for folks. I also appreciate that it's a concern not only for the students, some of whom are looking at this from a libertarian issue of saying, I want to choose not to do this. But professors looking at it saying, well, yeah, you guys are all 20-somethings who aren't going to die from this disease. Some of the professors are very older. They have they have these risk factors. They would die from the disease. So we're seeing this age conflict as well, where the younger folks are not as concerned. The older folks are very concerned and not wanting to be, I think it was someone saying, I don't want to be put out to pasture just because I'm older.
Dr. Leonard, I'm going to have to interrupt there. Dr. Robert Leonard, Dr. Lauren Van Scoy from Penn State College of Medicine, thank you very much. And our listeners can take the survey on our website, WITF.org. Tomorrow we talk about the accuracy of polls.